Warm welcome to the latest Wales Governance Centre podcast. Croeso, we are meeting the day after the publication of the draft Wales Bill. Political Wales is all a tizzy. It's a very complicated and pretty unwieldy read, I have to say. And to guide me and you through this, I'm very pleased to say that I'm joined by two experts in the field, Manon George from the Wales Governance Centre at Cardiff University, and Emyr Lewis, who is a legal practitioner at Blake Morgan, but is also heavily involved in the centre's work. Croeso i'r ddau ohonoch chi, warm welcome. So Manon, can I start with you? What were your initial reflections when you started reading through this draft yesterday?
Well, the first thing I did yesterday was turn to the list of reserved matters because the Wales Governance Centre, we've been saying that we should have a move to reserve powers model because it's generally considered to be a better way of devolving power so that you can legislate on anything except for what's reserved to Westminster. But of course, whether it's a better model or not depends on the list of reserved matters. And when you look at the new Schedule 7, there are lots of reserved matters and also a lot of restrictions on the Assembly's lawmaking powers.
So does that imply that you weren't impressed?
No, I wasn't that impressed, but it does make quite an interesting read and a good debate about it as well.
Because, I mean, the debate in the Senedd yesterday in Cardiff Bay, I thought, was striking. I thought the First Minister, Carwyn Jones, was imperious. I haven't seen him on that form before, and was clearly annoyed, I think genuinely annoyed, at the sense that their representations around this had been ignored. And he was arguing, and indeed the presiding officer, Rosemary Butler, has also argued that the Assembly is going to lose power as a result of these proposed changes. Is that right? Because that clearly isn't the impression that the Secretary of State, Stephen Crabb, wants us to glean.
Well, if you look at the correspondence between the First Minister and the Secretary of State for Wales, it's really striking to see a list of the acts passed by the Assembly and the Welsh Government arguing that they couldn't have passed a lot of those acts under the new model proposed in the draft bill.
Okay, why might that be the case, Emyr? I mean, do you share that analysis? And if so, can you explain what the problems are that are being highlighted here?
Yes, I do share that analysis. I've only had a quick opportunity to look at the First Minister's correspondence with Stephen Crabb, which runs to about 140 pages of stuff. So you take a deep breath and dive in. But it's very clear there that there are a number of bases for what the First Minister says. The first one is this: when you move from a conferred powers model to a reserved powers model, you are inevitably going to be losing some areas of competence. That was inevitable. It was inevitable, for instance, that the Assembly would lose power to legislate in relation to the armed forces or in relation to the to foreign affairs or the macroeconomics of the United Kingdom. Mm. That last one is actually already reserved, but accepted rather. However, what has happened in Schedule A and Schedule 7B of the new draft bill, and thank goodness it is only a draft, is to create further reservations, broader reservations than currently exist. And to create new areas of uncertainty around precisely how far the legislative competence of the Assembly goes. So whereas the original purpose of this bill was, and coming on from the Silk Commission, was to create a firmer and more clear starting point for the legislators in Cardiff Bay to know how far they could go, what they could do. Yeah. In my opinion, it's created new areas of uncertainty. There's a very useful flowchart which the First Minister has put in the Assembly Library. I think it may be available online. I'm not sure about that. But in any event, I hope it is, because people of Wales, or at least those who listen to Wales Government Centre's podcasts, go and have a look at that. And it shows very clearly those areas where, according to Karen Jones's analysts, this proposed settlement creates new areas of uncertainty and complication.
Okay, well, I mean, I think we need to probe that further, because, I mean, the Secretary of State, Stephen Crabb, presented the white paper back in February as something that would provide the basis of something that was clearer and was robust and was going to be more stable. You're directly contradicting that, as indeed is the Karen Jones. And he was saying, I mean, I heard him on Radio Wales yesterday telling Felicity Evans that all you need to do was read the draft and it all would become clear. I'm struggling with that one. So can you explain in a little bit more detail? I mean, what is the uncertainty? What is the what are the kind of problematic areas here?
There are several, but let me take one example. As things stand, the National Assembly is able to pass legislation which changes the criminal law, provided it relates to something it's already able to make a law about. Criminal law is not an excluded matter, not a reserved matter in any way at all. Under the new arrangements, under Schedule 7B, we have to sort of, again, dive into the depths in Schedule 7B, there is a new test for whether or not the National Assembly is able to legislate in respect of the criminal law. The starting point is it can't. It cannot legislate about the criminal law. Right? However, there are exceptions to that. And the exceptions to that are, first of all, if it's ancillary to something else that it can do, but secondly also that it only goes so far as is necessary. And there's this new necessity test, and nobody's quite sure how far that goes. And let me just paint a picture. The National Assembly creates a new offence in order to, for instance, in connection with the protection of children, creates a new offence. Somebody gets prosecuted for that offence. A solicitor representing him or barrister representing him or her in court says, this law should, the person should not be prosecuted under this law, because this law actually goes further than is necessary to achieve the devolved purpose, right? And what we've got is a recipe not just for litigation between governments and each other, which is what we've had so far, but for dismantling of Assembly legislation, or at least huge delay and expense caused by the new uncertainty for Assembly legislation in legal wrangles.
That's a pretty remarkable situation. I mean, I'm really intrigued by what you've just said at the start of that example, which was the starting point is it can't change the criminal law. I mean, that seems to me to be a deeply contradictory position. On the one hand, the government is saying it supports devolution, it wants to have a powerful legislature, devolved legislature in Wales, and yet the starting point is it shouldn't be changing the criminal law or the civil law. I mean, I presume the background to that, Manon, is the idea that you need to keep a single England and Wales legal jurisdiction and the implications of the way that's then being interpreted in Whitehall. Is that right?
Well, if the Assembly wants to make separate laws for Wales, they also need to be able to enforce those laws. And in doing that, they'll have to change the criminal law or civil law in order to enforce laws. So there's really no purpose making separate laws if you can't enforce them. But it seems that the UK government's concern is that if they're able to change aspects of the law, that will require a separate jurisdiction. And the UK government are strongly against creating a separate jurisdiction for Wales. They want to maintain an England and Wales common legal system.
Okay, but there seems to me, as a non-lawyer here, something deeply contradictory about the UK government's position here. I mean, if they're willing to have a Welsh legislature, then clearly it's going to create legislation, and yet there seems to be a real reluctance to accept the inevitable corollary of having a devolved legislature. Is that right, Emir? Or, I mean,
yes,
how would you view this?
Well, I'm not sure it's an inevitable corollary. Anything can be done. You can shape your constitution as you will. I think the question is how well it works.
Yeah.
And my personal view is that having a distinct jurisdiction, that is to say, the distinct concept that there is such a thing as the laws of Wales and the laws of England, and that there is such a thing as the legal territory of Wales and the legal territory of England, as opposed to England and Wales, which is what we currently have.
So we don't have that notion at the moment?
We don't. Right. Well, we don't as a matter of law. As a matter of fact, it exists.
Right.
And has existed, in my view, for quite a long time.
Yeah.
But once more, it's a case of you know, the law not recognising the facts.
Yeah.
That concept would solve a lot of the problems. It would create clarity. It would avoid the need for the kind of exceptions to the exceptions that we have here. There may be different types of exceptions, yeah. But they would provide a firmer and clearer starting point. That idea, right, shouldn't be confused with the idea that because you've got two distinct bodies of law and two distinct territories, therefore you must have two distinct sets of institutions, two distinct legal professions, etc., etc. Personally, I'd probably be in favour of that. But as a matter of common sense or a matter of reality, you don't have to have a different thing. As Alan Trench has powerfully argued, actually, on one of his recent blogs, and indeed as the Lord Chief Justice.
Well, I think that's fascinating, absolutely.
In the Legal Wales Conference a couple of weeks ago. So, the concept of a distinct Welsh law and distinct Welsh territory would help enormously.
Okay. One of the other things which Carwyn Jones was clearly very exercised about in yesterday's debate in the Senedd was the notion that Welsh law would require consent from what he described as English ministers. He had this very striking phrase of an English veto on Welsh laws. And in her remarks, Kirsty Williams, you know, recalled the whole ELCO system and the idea of Wales only legislating with UK level, let's be less contentious, UK level consent.
It was Welsh MPs who were causing the difficulties
indeed. So, I mean, what's the basis of that particular problem in the draft bill?
I think, again, there are several bases, but the principal basis is this. It's what I've just been talking about, which is that because of the broader way in which the exceptions work, and also these detailed restrictions around civil law, private law, and certain other things as well. There's also issues around Welsh public bodies. They can only legislate about Welsh public bodies, except for some really complicated exceptions. All of those things taken together mean two things. One, that there are less things the Assembly will be able to legislate about, or there are certain things the Assembly will no longer be able to legislate about, which previously it could, and for policy reasons the government may wish it to. And secondly, there is a greater area of ambiguity. There is a greater miasma of we're not quite sure, can we legislate here? Mm. The consequence of that is that you are going to need to go to Westminster or Whitehall to ask for consent to legislate in a greater number of areas, either because you clearly are no longer able to do it, or because you're not really very sure as to whether, for instance, whether you pass the necessity test. So let's get the Westminster to sprinkle holy water on it and then it'll be okay. A good example of this is the Organ Donation Act. The Human Tissue Authority is an authority which operates in both England and Wales. The Act confers functions on the Human Tissue Authority. It affects the Human Tissue Authority. The National Assembly was able to legislate on that without consent from London at all. It will no longer be able to do that, because the Human Tissue Authority falls outside this definition of a Welsh public authority. So but that's only one example amongst many examples.
So, and obviously one then, it's not surprising that people then recall the ELCO experience of consent and legislating essentially with consent, and potentially, of course, consent being withheld, and lots of potential political difficulties between Cardiff Bay and Westminster.
But one thing to be welcomed with Minister of the Crown functions, though, is that restriction that the Assembly cannot legislate on Minister of the Crown functions as that existed before the referendum is, well, I can't find it in Schedule 7, even there are other restrictions.
Yes.
That restriction which led to the first case in the Supreme Court involving Welsh law. I can't find that in there, so that's one thing we can welcome in the bill.
I think there are certain provisions here which deal with executive functions, which I haven't really managed to find a sufficiently large towel to wrap around my head, in a sufficiently dark room to go to think them through. But I'm not quite so sanguine as that.
Okay, let's try and accentuate the positive here. I mean, one of the things which Stephen Crabb was saying is that, you know, that the Assembly will have more powers in more areas as a result of this. So we've spoken about the problems with the way that the reserve powers model is being framed and the way that the implications of a single jurisdiction are being interpreted. What's the good news story, potentially at least, Manon, in terms of powers?
The draft bill does transfer some powers in relation to speed limits, traffic commissioners, energy. The Welsh ministers have been given more executive powers as well. The Assembly will also have more powers in relation to electoral arrangements. The bill also starts by saying that the Assembly for Wales is recognised as a permanent part of the UK, UK's constitutional arrangements. And it also adds that it's recognised that the Parliament of the UK will not normally legislate with regard to devolved matters without the consent of the Assembly. I'm not going to hold my breath on that.
Okay, I mean, and some of these powers are potentially at least quite significant on energy, perhaps, but also just in terms of the internal arrangements of the Assembly itself, that there is the potential here to change the electoral system and, you know, potentially increase the size of the Assembly. We've been involved in a report which suggested that 42 backbenchers really struggle to hold what is quite a powerful Welsh government to account. So there may be some positives in here. Emyr, you've been quite critical. Is there some, you know?
Well,
does the cloud have a silver lining?
There are definitely silver linings. It depends entirely on your perspective. And you know, the perspective we've been looking at it from is the perspective of a stable and clear settlement for the Welsh polity within the United Kingdom. If you look at it from the perspective of, for instance, economic or energy policy, some of the new powers, you know, the shiny beads, as it were, are useful. They are. They're things which the Welsh government's been asking for some time, and it's good to see that empowerment happening. It's a shame, though, that it comes with this degree of micromanagement of the broader picture, if I can.
Yeah, I mean, my overwhelming impression at reading the draft yesterday and earlier today was there's a grudging kind of attitude which runs through it. This is not a generous scheme of devolution. It's at least as much about controlling and micromanaging as it is about empowering. Or at least that was my impression. Is there something that can be salvaged here, Manon? Looking ahead, we've now got a strikingly brief period of pre-legislative scrutiny. It's all going to be done and dusted effectively by Christmas, which is a very short period of time, and certainly reading the Secretary of State's forward, he very much emphasises the role of the Select Committee, the Welsh Affairs Select Committee, in doing that pre-legislative scrutiny. And, you know, and it is also striking, and no criticism intended of the members, That's a very inexperienced parliamentary committee to be dealing with what is, by any measure, a very, very complicated piece of legislation. But, you know, given all those problems and this very compressed timetable, is there something in here? Can this be salvaged? Can this be turned into something that lives up to the Secretary of State's billing of being clear and robust and stable? Or you know, do they need to start again?
Well, what worries me is that a lot of the Silk Commission's recommendations have been completely ignored, and the bill doesn't go as far. It doesn't come close to what people and what people are expecting. So I think it'll be like a waiting game. Whatever comes from this bill, it'll be a waiting game for the next settlement. But Schedule 7 could be amended. It could be amended. The list of reserved matters could be amended, and so could the restrictions as well.
I mean, the Secretary of State would say, well, he wasn't trying to implement Silk. He was trying to implement what the parties could agree on in the St. David's Day process. So he would say that that is the starting point for this legislation rather than Silk. So I guess the question would be, is that starting point adequate? Can you build something which is more coherent on the basis of what was the, if you like, the lowest common denominator agreement at the beginning of the year?
And there was a lot of that. For instance, the schedules to that, which set out the areas in which you might be reserving, including civil and criminal law, I don't understand that to have been agreed by anybody. It was just proposed by the government. So, the fundamental issues and problems with the St. David's Day Agreement, of course, the reports published by the Wales Governance Centre and University College London a few weeks ago analyses the difficulties with that in some depth, it looks as though a lot of those issues picked up in that report are issues which Carwyn Jones and his people have picked up in their correspondence with Stephen Crabb. What we don't know is what Stephen Crabb's reasoned response is to those issues, and I think a lot depends on that. If there is a reasoned response to those issues, then I suspect there is room to reach some kind of accommodation. However, if there is not a reasoned response, and what we get is, I'm sorry, this is it, we are not moving on X, Y, or Z, for instance, the criminal law, we're not moving on that, then I fear that we are unlikely to reach, first of all, an accommodation, and secondly, a settlement which will survive for very long.
So we will have our fourth settlement, and we'll be settlement in inverted commas, and we'll be talking about our fifth very quickly.
If we've still got the energy.
The patience, yes. This may be a very pessimistic note in which to draw things to conclusion, but one of the things which is often said in retrospect about what was suggested for Scotland in the Scotland Act 1978 is if they had actually implemented that after 1979, that it just would not have worked. There would have been an almighty car crash, because the thing was just so unwieldy that many of the people who actually worked on drafting the legislation have said in retrospect that they're pleased it was never implemented because it would have been such a mess. If we don't see any movement and if the draft bill as published yesterday is very close to what is eventually enacted, I mean, are we in a position where this could become really very problematic in terms of the way that Wales is governed, or is that too alarmist a comparison and a suggestion?
Well, looking at the chart produced by Karen Jones for the competence test for assembly legislation, I wouldn't like to be drafting legislation under this system.
Or writing party manifestos for the assembly election.
Yes.
What about you, Emma? How alarmed should we be here?
Just thinking about the manifesto, which says we will only do that which is necessary. Which sounds rather menacing when you put it that way.
Be quite attractive to some people, actually.
Yeah. So, you know, we're not all Leninists. The way I see it is this: it is a draft, and therefore, presumably, is capable of being amended, as all drafts are, as we have a sober and grown-up discussion about these things. If it's not changed in some fundamental ways, then my first concern is about paralysis in Wales and a fear of being of legislation. And my second concern is the one I mentioned earlier, which is the increased capacity for legislation, which this legislation brings. Now, all legislation, in theory, brings the possibility of more litigation. But I think it would be unfortunate if the litigation about Welsh laws, the validity of Welsh laws, involved tests which just do not apply, as far as I'm aware, to the making of other laws, certainly in Scotland, Northern Ireland, and, of course, England.
This is, the politics of that is, the politics of this, of course, you say that this is a draft and it may well be amended, but the politics of this is, are we running up to an Assembly election? We now have what has clearly been a pretty, rancorous is maybe too strong a word, but pretty muscular correspondence, at least from Cardiff to London, is now all in the open. To change this fundamentally would involve an almighty climb down, public climb down by the Secretary of State. So I think the politics of that are actually quite difficult. But on the other hand, what's also striking is at the moment the Secretary of State doesn't seem to have many public allies in terms of defending what's in the draft.
I think it would be really interesting to understand his reasons for his rebuttal, if you like, of what Carwyn has put in the public domain. It would be really interesting to see that, because if he's got good reasoned arguments, then that will be a starting point at least.
But if it's just my way or the highway, then it's going to be very difficult.
Well, that's that's a political question, really, isn't it? I just hope, you know, I can't remember who it was. It was one of the American presidents said, you know, advice to lawyers: avoid litigation. There's plenty of work for lawyers without it, you know. And you want to see peace. You want to see harmony. You want to see a settlement that works.
Well, that's a suitably uplifting place to finish our conversation. This is a pretty indigestible and complex piece of legislation, which is going to be the subject of debate and almost certainly controversy over the next few weeks and months. And I'm sure that we'll return to this issue at some point in the relatively near future. But in the meantime, can I thank both of you, Manon and Emyr, for your company, and to you for listening. Goodbye, Will Bowery.